Coming up on today's program, searching for superpowers and stained glass windows. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISA Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. We'll begin our search for those stained glass windows later in the program. We've also got Veterans Voices and Dan Patterson with another edition of Blue Skies and Tailwinds. Up first, let's talk about those superpowers. This week, we're kicking off the new season of WISO Youth Radio, our original program that puts local teens behind the microphone to tell their own stories. Here's the first piece from this year's Youth Radio cohort.
Hey there, I'm Lee Wade, and you just tuned into WISO Youth Radio. What if the greatest superpowers weren't flying, invisibility, or super strength, but the everyday abilities that help us survive high school and life? A teen-led group in Clark County called BATS, bringing awareness to students, stopped by WISO to share their real-life superpowers.
Hi, my name is Mary Cunningham. I'm a senior at the Miami Valley High School. Sometimes it all just feels like too much. All the pressure, all the noises. But I have a superpower. I breathe. Your superpower is already inside of you. Just breathe. If your anxiety or stress feels like more than you can handle, talk to someone you trust or call or text 988, the Crisis Lifeline. You are not alone. When I first started, struggling with stress and feelings of being overwhelmed and anxiety in middle school, it was really hard to get through those moments by breathing and slowing down. But, as I've talked with more people and gotten more comfortable with myself, I've definitely got a lot better at just taking a beat and, taking a second in some high-stress situations. And I think forcing myself to, be in uncomfortable situations where I can feel comfortable and grow and be with people and, just like form a connection has really helped me.
My name is Anaya Westmoreland, and I am a sophomore at Greenan High School. I'm not good enough. You're learning and growing every day. I always mess things up. Mistakes help you improve. I can't do this. You can do hard things. Just take it one step at a time. Everyone else is better than me. You're on your own path to success, and that's enough. Negative self-talk can feel loud, but it isn't the truth. The way you talk to yourself matters. Be patient. Be kind. Don't let those thoughts control you and keep you down. You are stronger than your negative doubts. Let your positive self-talk be your superpower.
I would say this is definitely a superpower I developed over time because I have struggled with negative self-talk all of my life. I believe that I truly wasn't good enough, and it took time to realize that I am, and I did that by combating that with positive self-talk.
Hi, my name is Lively Geringer. I am a sophomore at School of Innovation High School in Springfield, Ohio. A superpower that I have and that I feel like I utilize greatly is my ability to understand other people, and I feel like I figured this out when I got my certification in teen mental health first aid because I had many people coming to me asking for my support and my advice, and that was a time when I really had to step back and think about what made a person think this way, what caused them to do certain things, and how I could better understand them to approach the situation and make it easier for them to live and enjoy life. And I feel like my ability to understand has created more like connections with the people around me, and I think that's very beautiful. One question I've been asked is this a superpower that I was born with or one that I developed over time? I feel like growing up in the situation I grew up, which was very hippie parents in the middle of nowhere, that you grow, you have to learn to understand. You're constantly being taught, this is how people interact. This is how people love each other. But I believe that it was developed over time to become a superpower and not just an ordinary trait.
Thank you to BATS for sharing their superpowers with us. You'll be hearing more from the Bringing Awareness to Students group from Clark County in the coming weeks on WISO Youth Radio. Special thanks to Beth Dixon for helping bring this project to life. WYSO Youth Radio is made possible with support from the Ohio Arts Council, and it's produced right here at WYSO and the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices.
Catch a brand new episode of WYSO Youth Radio every Thursday, and of course, we'll have the replay for you here on this program every weekend. Cincinnati's Mercantile Library is trying to solve a mystery involving stained glass, women's suffrage, and a church in small-town Indiana. WVXU's Nick Swartzel has more.
All right, well, art, objects, and collectibles.
Mercantile Library Executive Director John Faraday leafs through a catalog of items currently or once held by the almost 200-year-old Cincinnati institution.
This is one that's exciting. Declaration of Independence. And then parenthetically, in Chinese. Bible folio size printed in Nuremberg, 1479.
Faraday isn't after obscure copies of America's founding documents or rare medieval Bibles. Eventually, he comes to what he's looking for.
1884, the Three Arts stained glass window, source George A. Bowen. And then 20 years later, Woman with a Book stained glass window, source Augustine Ogden.
The listings and some black and white photos are the only traces left of two large stained glass windows that once adorned the south-facing wall of the library on Walnut Street downtown. One made in 1884 featured the visage of Shakespeare and arts-themed motifs. The other, from 1904, pictured a standing woman peering deep into a book. The windows were removed in the late 1960s and then disappeared. Faraday has visions that someday they'll cast their colorful light on the library's hardwood floors again.
They might be in someone's basement. They might be in Colorado. We have no idea where they are. I would love to find them, and I would love to bring them back. I don't know if that's possible, but I've been here for 10 years, and I have wanted them back since the first time I heard about them.
How the windows went missing is a mystery. The library doesn't own the building it's in, but holds a 10,000-year lease on the space. When the owners of the Mercantile's building decided to brick up the windows, they took out the stained glass and stored it at the Cincinnati Art Museum. This is where things start to get murky.
It's all very confusing. There's letters going back over about a 15-year period.
Faraday reads a letter the art museum sent the owners in the 1970s.
Because of our very limited storage space and our inability to exhibit these windows, we are anxious to return them and are now asking for instructions concerning the return.
The building owners had the windows transferred to a downtown auction house soon after that letter. Faraday says he has one last tantalizing clue after that point. Records show the windows were shipped out of Cincinnati in April 1982.
The windows went to Riverview Baptist Church, 405 West Main Street, VV, Indiana, 47043. And they were signed for by a guy named Garrett Bledsoe.
From there, the trail goes cold. The windows aren't at the church. Bledsoe died in 2005, and his family has said they don't remember them. An appraisal in the 1970s revealed the windows weren't high-value items, at least not in monetary terms. Historian Catherine Dirac thinks they're important, though. She's especially interested in the later one, picturing a woman reading a book. It was commissioned by prominent Cincinnati suffragist Augustine Ogden. The window was a near copy of a tapestry displayed in the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago. Ogden had it created in 1904, in part to pay tribute to her late husband, Frank Ogden. But it's also a nod to the Mercantile's history supporting women's rights. The library opened membership to women in 1859, an uncommon move at the time, and the wife of one of its early directors published a pioneering feminist periodical.
Even though it was the Young Men's Mercantile Library Association, an early director, Otis Aldrich, his wife publishes The Genius of Liberty, which is one of the very first feminist publications in the United States.
Dirac is also a textile artist. She's made her own reproduction of the window as a quilt, part of a series of quilts she's done commemorating Ohio's women's suffrage history. To her, the window's placement in the library sent a powerful and resonant message.
The fact that here's a woman reading in the Young Men's Mercantile Library that establishes a model, that opens a door. So I guess this is a case where the window opens a door.
But could the windows ever make their way back to the library? Faraday isn't giving up the search. He's taken to social media, posting the history of the stained glass windows in the hopes someone may just know where they are. Nick Swartzel, WVXU.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. And joining me in studio for today's program is Tom. And I'm just going to call you Tom for a second because you're very new to the station, and this will be the first time I have tried to pronounce your last name out loud. Tom Salvatierra?
You got it.
All right.
Indeed.
Great. So, Tom, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're very new to WYSO, and you're here as a full-time engineer.
Yes, I am the new guy, and I am the staff broadcast engineer, which means, in a nutshell, I'm the guy that fixes the electronic boxes when they go south.
We're very happy to have you on staff. You worked with another colleague of ours in the way past.
I did. I am a former colleague of WISO music director Juliet Frumholt, and we both worked at Wright State University's campus radio station, WWSU, many years ago. I won't say exactly how many, but it is a long-time working relationship for sure, and thrilled to be working with Juliet once again in more or less the same capacity. Well, she was the production director at the time, I believe, and then station manager, yeah. But I was chief engineer of the WWSU operation at the time as well, and so kind of cool for things to come full circle and to be back here. Now working at WISO.
Are you a Wright State grad?
Yes, I attended grad school at Wright State and got my master's and then PhD.
So outside of radio, are you a Dayton area, Southwest Ohio native?
For many years, yes. Not originally from this area, but did my undergrad at UD, and then having grown up in the Midwest and then bounced around to the East Coast for many years, but came back here for college and then just sort of never left. Although I did finish at Wright State, I did take a detour back up north to Michigan, where I am originally from, and worked there for a couple of years and came back here for the opportunity that came along at WISO, and I'm very happy to be back.
That's great. So we're a mix of news and music. Where do your interests fall in that spectrum?
I would say mostly in the music sphere, although I do my level best to keep tabs on what's going on news-wise, yeah. And have always been very impressed by the caliber of both the local and national reporting carried by WYSO. So that's very cool to be a kind of a part of on the ground now, yeah. Too, at least in the operational aspect.
What kind of music do you like?
I tend to gravitate, I would suppose, towards rock, pop, both modern and older stuff. But I definitely, you know, cut my teeth in college radio and beyond on the music side of things. So that's, again, probably what I know the most and was certainly central to my prior role at WWSU because of our programming there consisted, and I think currently still consists of primarily music.
What was it like growing up? Were you a musical family?
That's a great question. Parents always pushed me to, you know, do well in the traditional STEM fields, although neither of them are engineers per se, but that was always emphasized in terms of academics and, you know, thinking about what you should do when you grow up. But both my parents are also pretty big into music, or at least there was always music playing in the house growing up and in the car. So both, you know, radio, and it was interesting for me several years later in talking to friends of mine. Just it was very interesting to find how many households didn't have a lot of music growing up. And so I guess I sort of took that for granted, but we did not always have the latest and greatest tech at home, but we always had music playing. And it was, I would say in hindsight, pretty good music. So hats off to my parents for exposing me to that at an early age. And I would say engendering a lifelong love of music for everything from classical to pop, you know, top 40 radio to more straight up rock and roll. Got a little bit of all of it growing up, and that was pretty cool.
Anything else you want to talk about? Any hobbies?
Well, like many folks at WYSO, I am, well, in my case, I would say I'm a very amateur musician. There, I would say most of the folks here who are musicians are a bit more talented than I am. That being said, I enjoy playing keyboards, piano, and organ. I have played live music in the past, but that has been an ongoing interest of mine for the past several years. And I would say most recently, though, I would say my musical hobbies have drifted a little more towards collecting as opposed to playing, although I obviously still play for my own amusement. But presently, my thing is cassette tapes, and I can't get enough of them. I buy them. I listen to them. Some of them don't work, and I have to either fix them or toss them out the window. But I have just been enamored with the cassette format as of late. Really, that's definitely a going back to roots sort of scenario, because yeah. I do remember going back to the music in my house growing up. There was always a Walkman and a cassette tape lying around handy somewhere, and many memories of enjoying that particular format. And as I have sort of rediscovered pop and rock of the 80s and 90s, I have drifted back into that period appropriate format, I guess you could say, and have gotten into collecting cassette tapes.
Well, that's something I'm going to hit you up on, because I've got a lot of cassette tapes that I haven't heard for obviously decades.
Oh, sure.
Don't have a tape player. I'm not sure if they would even make it through a run at this point. So we'll have a conversation about that off air. Tom Salvatierra with WYSO, one of our newest employees. Really glad that you're here, and thanks so much for the conversation.
Well, I'm very glad to be here, and thank you, Jerry, for taking the time to chat.
Up next on WYSO Weekend, Marine Corporal Tony Stein was just 23 years old when he was killed in the Battle of Iwo Jima. Days earlier, his courage under fire set in motion the actions for which he would later be awarded the Medal of Honor. But behind the battlefield heroics was a quiet kid from Dayton, Ohio, remembered by family as humble, athletic, and deeply devoted to duty. This week on Veterans Voices, Marine Corps veteran Zach Sliver sits down with Stein's relatives to reflect on a legacy that still lives on nearly 80 years later.
Marine Corporal Tony Stein grew up in Dayton, Ohio, during the Great Depression. Friends and family remembered him as quiet, athletic, and determined. But on the black sand beaches of Iwo Jima in February 1945, Stein became a legend. Stein landed in the first wave of Marines during the bloodiest battles of World War II. Enemy fire pinned the Marines down almost immediately. Armed with a homemade machine gun he called the Stinger, Stein charged directly into Japanese fire. Witnesses said that he attacked enemy positions almost single-handedly, firing while standing out in the open. But what most fellow Marines remembered was what he did for the others. Again and again, Tony Stein carried the wounded Marines to safety. Then he turned around and went right back into the fight. By the end of the day, he had crossed open ground under enemy fire multiple times to rescue fellow Marines and deliver ammunition to the front lines. For those actions, Stein received the Medal of Honor, becoming Dayton's only World War II Medal of Honor recipient. Corporal Tony Stein was killed in combat just days after his heroic actions on Iwo Jima. He was 23 years old. Stein's story still lives in Dayton today. Drivers across the Tony Stein Memorial Bridge on Kiwi Street, and not far away, Tony Stein Way, carries his name throughout the neighborhood where he grew up. Recently, I visited with Tony Stein's extended family, Susan Jones, whose mother was Stein's cousin, and Susan's daughter, Julie Lewis. Together, we flipped through the family scrapbook filled with faded photographs, wartime letters, and newspaper clippings. Here's Julie.
These are a collection of quotes that I found, like this one from Eleanor Sluzes, the prior restaurant owner of Amber Rose, and she was a close neighbor from where he lived, he and his mother. But it says, Tony was a raw-boned, rugged kid who put his heart and soul into everything he did. He was a child of destiny who became a leader of men. His mother tried to keep him from war, but he told all of his family and friends that it was his duty. He owed it to his country.
Yeah. The Marine Corps is really good about keeping the memory of the fallen alive. Mm-hmm. So at every Marine Corps ball, they have a table for the lost, and they go and they do a toast to every war.
Mm-hmm.
It says a lot about the service that they're willing to give.
Right.
The ultimate service to give one's life.
Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting quotes that I found from Tony's mom was the Dayton Herald on February 20th of 1946 that, "You may not believe it, but I knew when my Tony died. I said to my daughter that night, 'Tony's dead.' And later we found out it was true. Our house shook, the furnace door blew clear off and across the room. I don't know how it could, but it did that night. The plaster in the front room cracked from one side to the other, and I had the strangest feeling all over that something terrible had happened. I never heard word from Tony after they sent him to Iwo Jima."
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of funny when I tell people the story of what he did on Iwo Jima. Usually sometimes the reaction is that just sounds impossible and improbable. But when you think about how he learned to be athletic and learned to adapt and overcome, and I just kind of feel like you have to know who he was to have it make sense what he did on Iwo Jima.
Well, I find like a lot of times when I go and I talk, let's say, to a grandchild and telling them about it, and I will say that, you know, he was a war hero and that, you know, he died and that saving people, and their eyes get all big. And before you know it, because kids are so glued to their phones and stuff, they're looking it up. They're looking it up, trying to get more information.
This is again from the Amber Rose restaurant owner. And she said, "We must never let the memory of Tony or his legacy die. The younger generation needs to know of him."
Yeah.
That was Marine Corps veteran Zach Sliver speaking with Susan Jones and Julie Lewis, remembering their relative, Tony Stein. Veterans Voices is presented by RightPath Credit Union. Additional support comes from the Dayton Ombudsman Veterans Transition Team and Montgomery County Veterans Service Commission. You can find more online at wiso.org. Coming up next on WISO, it's Today from the Ohio Newsroom.
Support comes from Ohio CASA. Ohio CASA's mission is to ensure children experiencing abuse and neglect have a caring, trained adult in their corner. Information about CASA volunteer work is at ohiocasa.org.
Today from the Ohio Newsroom takes you around the state, connecting you with news and neighbors from all over Ohio. I'm Kendall Crawford. For years, there's been a push to create better broadband infrastructure in rural areas where access to high-speed internet can be hard to come by. Now Wright State University is tackling a new digital frontier, artificial intelligence. The university is using a federal grant to develop a curriculum for rural educators on how to teach AI. Kogan Shemizu is leading the project. He's an assistant professor of computer science at Wright State. Hello.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Happy to talk with you. So Wright State received over $2 million from the U.S. Department of Education's Fund for the Improvement of Post-Secondary Education to tackle AI literacy in rural areas. What is that going to look like in practice?
Oh boy. So we actually promised quite a lot for this particular grant. This spans from pre and in-service teachers, so taking a look at the training that teachers are receiving in order to understand how AI is going to impact them and their classroom, but in addition to actually teaching these AI concepts to students, right? Factually, what this looks like is we're looking at tool deployment as well as course development, so that way both the teachers and the students have this opportunity to interact with these tools and understand how they can or shouldn't be used within a classroom.
Mm-hmm. And why do rural areas need their own AI curriculum? Why can't they use the same kind of playbooks that teachers have in cities?
Ultimately, rural communities deserve specific attention because their obstacles are different, right? Different sorts of needs, different sorts of communities, different sorts of ways of life, and the way that AI is going to impact the ways of life is distinctly and observably and significantly different than how it might affect communities in denser areas or with areas with different types of infrastructure available to them and so on.
To some people, though, it might seem like putting the cart before the horse. There are some areas in Ohio that still don't have consistent internet access. So why should AI training be the priority?
AI training is really important even when you don't have access to internet, not necessarily because you're being trained to use AI, because you're being trained to be literate in AI. Even if you will never touch one of these AI tools, other people may be, other systems may be, other government processes, all of these people are using these different varieties of AI systems to make decisions that are going to impact people's lives, right? And in the same way that you need to be conversant about your rights as a human, as a citizen, right? You need to be conversant and literate in your understanding of your AI rights, right? How are these things impacting you?
Your project, it's going to focus on rural schools in Ohio and Kansas. What do you hope results from the training?
Oh, I mean, of course, obviously, literacy, right? This can be measured in a number of different ways. We're trying to reach as many different schools that are out there as possible. Really, it's a bilateral thing, right? We're not trying to come in and understand, like, or try and say, like, no, this is how you should use AI, right? Let's make sure that we're not growing any divides or instituting any obstacles between our communities and the universities and other centers of education.
That's Kogan Shamazoo, a Wright State professor who's helping to design a curriculum on AI literacy for rural schools. Thanks so much for talking with us about your project.
Thank you for having me.
That's all today from the Ohio Newsroom. We'll talk with you tomorrow.
Up next on Blue Skies and Tailwinds, we enter the hidden world of the freight dogs, the cargo pilots who fly through the night carrying the parts, packages, and supplies that keep modern life moving. From the Wright brothers' first commercial delivery flight in Ohio more than a century ago to storm-tossed cargo runs hauling auto parts between factories in the Midwest, aviation has long been about more than passengers. Here's Dan Patterson.
Almost from the start, aviation has been the vehicle to get stuff wherever it needs to go faster. The first commercial flight was in a Wright Flyer to deliver a bolt of silk to a department store in Columbus, Ohio. The flight was made in November of 1911 and followed the railroad tracks. Then the weather turned stormy, and the Flyer returned to Dayton on a rail car on the same tracks the pilot had followed east. There's a culture of aviators who proudly wear the title of freight dog. These pilots fly the stuff we all depend on, often at night and in all kinds of nasty weather. Flying has evolved a lot since 1911. Radio beacons have given way to global positioning systems, the GPS, and sophisticated electronic navigation tools, which fit the information, which was hundreds of pages of data, into a smartphone or tablet, and those wonderful tools stay updated. Reliable and sturdy aircraft which carry people can also be adapted for cargo. The seats, the overhead bins all come out, and the fuselage filled with cargo and cargo of all imaginable varieties. The familiar boxes from FedEx, UPS, and the post office are just the tip of the iceberg. The creation of just-in-time inventory systems for industrial companies does save them enormous amounts of money in warehousing and storage, but depend on the rest of the support industry to keep the production lines flowing with the various and essential parts which make up a finished product, such as a completed automobile. But the same can be said for just about any product. When General Motors, which is a much larger element of the Southwest Ohio economy, with factories making parts, the supply chain and getting all the stuff to the final assembly plants was an industry to itself. Bringing the final assembly lines to a screeching halt was to be avoided at all costs. When the inventory available got low and the over-the-road deliveries would take too long, then the parts went by air. Auto parts, by their nature, are heavy, so the aircraft has to be able to carry the weight of the freight. The post-World War II availability of cargo planes filled that bill. The cargo planes which carried paratroopers were now carrying auto parts. Soon, purpose-built cargo planes began to appear. Airliners had big cargo doors added, and some never carried passengers again. Freight airlines were created, Flying Tigers, Atlas Air, Kalata, Emery, and even locally, Hogan Air. The World War II planes could operate from smaller airports near the factories. An entire new aviation business began to flourish. One freight dog was a pilot named James Walker Ledbetter. He flew out of Michigan and was known for telling hair-raising stories of flying the freight. He proved the saying that there are old pilots and bold pilots, but very few old and bold pilots. One episode he recounted were missions to fly auto bumpers. From the plant, they were made somewhere in Ohio to a final assembly plant somewhere in Michigan. So you have to figure the cost of flying heavy chrome-plated bumpers was less than the cost of shutting down production. The customer didn't care that the weather was bad. They had deadlines. Now, bumpers can be stacked together and loaded into the airplane, but that just multiplied the weight. The airplanes often flew at max gross weight or more, but they flew. One night's flights were in twin-engine cargo planes, and the weather was pretty nasty. These flights were often at lower altitudes than passenger flights, and that meant in the weather. Storms have dramatic updraft, and then the opposing downdrafts. Really rough flying. Most of the flights made it through, but an unfortunate plane got caught in the wind shears, which overwhelmed the structural integrity of the airplane, and it began to come apart. Ledbetter didn't talk about the cruise, but after taking a long drag on his Pall Mall cigarette, he said, "Boy, it was raining bumpers." For WISO, this is Dan Patterson, wishing you blue skies and tailwinds.
Blue Skies and Tailwinds is sponsored by Sinclair Community College and produced at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WYSO. That puts us out of time. We'll get back to Bird Note in our next program. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of WISO Weekend. Our podcast is available to download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And our theme music, Another Beautiful Day in Paradise, is provided by Magnolia Bolthead. Join us again next weekend, and we'll have more highlights and conversations for you then.